Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 493rd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And just like the fourth wave of COVID, we're back with COVID.
Yeah, we're back talking about COVID. And so we need to first of all, talk about what we're going to talk about, yeah. Which is we're going to call it long COVID, but it goes by a host of names. I looked up the names for it, just kind of looked up differences in names. There were greater than 10 names in the literature for it: persistent, chronic, long haul, post-COVID manifestations. So it went on and on and on, but it looks like the people who are writing review articles and that kind of thing are saying, let's call it long COVID-19.
And it actually sounds like something you could understand. Makes kind of sense. But let's just let people know that this is a tools for practice that just came out. And it was done by people who you've definitely heard on the podcast before: Tony Nikinchuk, Jessica Kirkwood, and Nicholas Dugray.
Nick.
And Nick, you as well.
Yes, and me, and I'm the least author, I think, is.
Yeah, that's what it says in there. It says Mike Allen, not much of an author on the paper. It's weird.
Not much of a
blank. But this is important because, you know, we hear about it, and what we're going to do is as best we can is give you the numbers, I think, and what you might see.
Yeah, and so it's important to kind of also remember one of the reasons why I thought this was an important topic. And it obviously is an important topic, period. But why I felt it was really important to talk about long COVID is because serious infections are known to cause persistent symptoms after the acute phase is done. And what we know as well with people and vaccines is when we're talking about motivating people to take vaccines, it's not really about trying to counter their misinformation. That has actually been found to actually polarize them the other way.
Yeah, it makes them more angry.
Yeah. And so one of the things to talk about that's been found is the illness itself. And I think that not only can COVID create a serious acute phase for patients and really disrupt your life, like 2 weeks, and even if you're not that sick, you're 2 weeks quarantined at home. But it also has potentially long-term consequences. And no one wants to be sick for months on end. And I think that's another good talking point for us with our patients about, you know, it's not just the acute phase. There's a fair chance that when you get this, you could be sick for a long time afterwards.
And it's different than, you know, with, you know, typical flu or even the cold where, you know, you can have symptoms for, you know, 2 weeks. You know, the average, I think, time for a cough is what, 12 days or something like that with any of these sorts of things. But that happens a lot because, you know, these are acute things and it takes a while to get over. But we're talking about much longer time period. We're not talking 2 days, or 2 weeks or 4 weeks. This is at least according to the data that people are looking at, this is 2 months. And that's a long time.
Yeah, and longer. So we'll talk about.
Yeah, no, but that's where that's
2 months.
Yeah.
So there is a surprising amount of research on this, just how well it's been studied. Mm-hmm. And we, of course, we reviewed as much as we possibly could. There was four of us pulling studies. And just let's first talk about the risk of getting long COVID. And the biggest thing to remember is it varies a lot by how they design these studies, the population they're studying, who's doing them. So for example, one that we didn't include here because it was so different from a classic design, it was on apps. And so it was young people who were reporting symptoms and it was less with them, for example. And then people who were sicker and older and frail, they were followed with phone calls. And so it's all over the map who's being studied here. Some people it was mostly those who were ICU admitted. Others, it was anyone who had a COVID diagnosis. So with that in mind, and they solicited patient symptoms in most of these, which means they asked you, do you have a cold? Do you feel like you have a cough? Do you feel like you're tired? Do you feel short of breath at all? So that we know also can inflate these things.
Yeah. And just I don't know, I don't think we mentioned a specific definition, but what we're primarily talking about is having one or more symptoms 60 days post the infection.
Yeah, after your acute phase. So some people defined it as 2 weeks after. Mm-hmm. Some people defined it as persisting 60 days, etc. What we're going to look is how many people have a symptom at 60 days. And there were four systematic reviews of observational studies. So just to be clear, observational studies are what you do here. You don't do randomized. You don't randomize people to get long COVID or to get COVID.
You could. It would be a hell of a difficult to get into ethics.
Yeah, it would be a pretty strong thing to get through ethics. So patients reporting one or more symptoms at 60 days was 72% to 80% of these patients. Now, these studies were in the higher risk groups in general, and that was early in the course of COVID. So there are newer cohort studies that we also looked at, and looking at kind of one or more symptoms at 60 days, patients who had been diagnosed with COVID-19 had about a 22% to 44% risk of having one or more symptom at 2 months out. So that even that, to me, is concerning.
Yeah, well, it tells you that COVID-19 is a real thing. Like
it's a bugger.
Yeah, exactly.
To say the least. So compared to that, and then what they did in a couple of these is they also looked at people who were either just matched to look like the population, so matched for age and gender and let's say postal code, so you're getting the socioeconomic stuff a little more. All of that stuff was matched up. Or they looked at people who were similar, who went for tests but were negative. So in other words, they had likely had some kind of symptomology that required testing. So to compare that to the kind of 20 to 44% numbers, or 22 to 44% numbers, what we're looking about is a little bit higher than that to 24% difference between that we can say that COVID causes additional long-term symptoms. Mm-hmm. Another way to look at it is say who actually sought out care for long COVID. So that's different than soliciting symptoms. So soliciting symptoms could be, you can imagine I or James has gone through a bout of COVID, and then we're going on with our regular life 2 months later, and someone phones and says, hey, you know, do you have any headaches? Do you have any cough, anything like that? And that's different because it might be mild and I'm just irritated by it, but I'm not going in. So these are people who are actually seeking care. Mm-hmm. And in those patients, it was 15% of patients who had long COVID. When they matched control patients, it was 9% of them. So it was 6% more were seeking care. And then they actually did something really interesting in this study. They took people who had a diagnosis of things like viral pneumonia, tuberculosis, all sorts of kind of bad kind of lower respiratory infections, not including bacterial infections. Mm-hmm. They didn't give those, but other types of or classic bacterial pneumonia. So when they compared to those, it was about 13% who had ongoing symptoms compared to 15% with long COVID. So
for all intents and purposes, the same.
Yeah, it's a lot ways the same, but it's, if anything, as bad or worse.
Yes, so
this
is
reminding us that this condition, and these were lots of patients studied in that.
And tuberculosis is a bad thing.
Yeah,
And you heard it here first.
And we might want to give a pause for a moment in the podcast so someone can write that down.
Yeah, please write that down. Yeah.
That's a pearl.
Tuberculosis, not good. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about here we're laughing about tuberculosis. We're laughing about what James said. Okay, so common symptoms. This is the other part. So now what we've found is that if you're talking about any symptoms, it could be a range of 20% of people all the way up to 80%, depending on the population and all of those things. Let's talk about what symptoms are common. And these are systematic reviews, again, from anywhere from 10 to 45 studies and 2,000 or so to almost 50,000 patients. And the most common symptoms at 60 days are fatigue, and that's 40 to 58%. Dyspnea, or shortness of breath, is 24 to 37%. Anosmia, which is loss of smell, and that is 17 to 24%. And then we clustered memory loss, cognitive decline, and confusion together, but understand that each one of these has a risk somewhere of 7 to 28%. So it's a kind of feeling fuzzy in the brain is not an uncommon symptom for people post suffering from long COVID-19.
Or just us in general.
Yeah. Or those who listen to this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Cough is 14 to 19. Atypical chest pain or discomfort, 13 to 24. Anxiety or depression, each is 12 to 22%. Headache, 12 to 44%. So that could be quite common in some studies. Insomnia or sleeping troubles, each one, because they were given differently, was 11 to 29%. Loss of taste is 9 to 23%. And general pain, muscle aches, again, all of these things, anywhere from 15 to 25% each. So there is a lot of symptoms. Fatigue, shortness of breath are the most common.
Yeah. And remember, then, that's after 60 days, or at least up to 60 days.
You know, yeah, these are 60 days. Yeah. So there's still a lot of lingering symptoms for people. Risk of long COVID was really inconsistent. I have to say that first. But what we tried to find is any kind of predictors that were at 2 times risk that were found in more than one study. So when we looked at that, there are some things. That is female sex, more severe initial infections, or more initial symptoms, and increasing age. So the more severe initial infections was more common in men, but the long COVID is slightly more common in women. So just that it's a bit of a quandary, or you know, a conundrum of how that can happen, but it is what's been found relatively consistently. I think as we get larger studies and all of that, we'll see this teased out a little bit better. But
it is difficult to try and identify sort of predictors. We're just sort of giving some, and now you are looking at 2 times higher risk, so that gives you some. That amount of increased risk gives you some comfort that it's a real predictor, but it's tricky, and it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really help. It just tells you that this type of people are more likely to get it. It doesn't tell us anything about what to do about it.
Yeah, and it certainly doesn't solve the problem.
No,
you know,
no.
You're not going to tell someone a story. You know, you've got COVID, and you've had a bad case of it. You're older and you're female, so you've got to, you know, and once they get it, you have to wait until they get it, really, and then you can't.
Yeah.
Looking back and saying, oh, it was because you had a more severe infection
or
you were older, that's not going to help you. So it's just interesting for us from a kind of science perspective. And then one of the things I thought was interesting was most of these are subjective, of course. So what if you looked objectively at it? And one of the things you have to realize is these studies are almost always done post hoc. So you've had COVID. Now I'm going to do a bunch of blood tests and CT scans and MRIs to see what we can see, but we don't know what was actually there beforehand. And the only way they can come close to that is they get controls who are similar to you in other ways and see if you have abnormalities on, let's say, MRI. So just with that in the context, and these people were more severe cases, 200 of them or so, and they were given an MRI study, and it was MRI of the whole body. And they found that they could find markers of inflammation in the MRI for the pancreas, the liver, and the heart at about 12 to 19% for each one for patients, versus 0 to 6% of controls had it for each one of those. So you can see the heart, to be honest, wasn't quite statistically significant, but it was one of these P equals 0.06 things, so I don't really care. And I think I just find that interesting that, you know, the more skeptical of us and stuff might go, oh, yeah, these, they're symptoms. How much of it is in their mind and all this stuff. No, it's, there's something going on for these patients.
And it tells you that COVID is not just a lung thing.
Yeah, it's not just a lung thing. So it's, you know, for those who are skeptical and don't believe that long COVID is a thing, no, it's actually, there is something happening there. And it is, as I mentioned, it's more common. If you have a severe infection, it's not uncommon for you to have lingering symptoms. And this is just one of those severe infections. The same thing was found in a study of hospitalized COVID patients who got at 90 to 120 days, still had one symptom, and they did a CT of them. 63% had changes on lung CT. Mm-hmm. Some with ground glass appearance, that was the majority, and then some with fibrotic lesions. And actual cognitive testing, like the MoCA, 38% had some level of impairment. Now, they didn't define that, which was very frustrating mm-hmm. for us, but it's interesting because I remember my co-authors were blown away by that number, 38% at 90 to 120 days. But we don't have anything to compare to.
Yeah.
But we can say that those patients are, on average, 57. So they're not people we should be finding a lot of cognitive impairment
in. No, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the effect of time. So we've kind of gone over so far, what's your risk of getting it, or what's the risk of patients getting it? What's the symptoms they have? What are the risk factors? And is there really any objective findings? And the answer to that is yes. And last thing is kind of the effect of time. So when you look at symptoms over time, they do decline, not as fast as maybe we'd hope, but they're generally in decline. So people with one or more symptoms at 60 days, in this study, that was 26% at 60 days. At 120 days, it was 21%. And at 240 days or 8 months, it was 15%.
And I know you are saying it's declining, but boy, that is not very fast.
Not fast enough.
And not much.
Right? That's, you know, one in eight people are still symptomatic.
Yeah. And that's, and, you know, that's, what are we at? Two,
eight
that's
months.
8 months, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's eight.
So six in, over 6 months, it goes from 26% to 15.
So individual symptoms follow similar patterns. So I'm going to give you the one for loss of smell, because I think that's one that is really kind of well known by people. Mm-hmm. So if you look at loss of smell, 15% have it at 60 days, at 11% have it at 120 days, and 9% have it at 240 days. Yeah. So you're looking at that, you know, moving from 4 months to 8 months, you're really looking at only getting rid of 2% more, get a return in their smell. So. Yeah.
And I think it's an important thing to know, because you'll get asked the questions, you know, I have this symptom, if you will, you know, what's the chance that it's going to get better?
Yeah, so it's almost half at 8 months from 2 months, but still, that's it's still a long way to go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. And other studies found similar with kids. The evidence is really scant, I would say, but mm-hmm. there is some study that they have a lower risk of long COVID. And again, the studies are so limited that we can't get too excited about that information. But it looks like I saw in the newspaper some story about some kid or kids with it, but I don't. Yeah. I think if you look at the research, there's just not a lot of research on it, and
we can hang your hat on a particular number. And I mean, and even the bottom line is, we're saying, or when I say we, I mean the four of you guys who did a great job of this, by the way, we're talking it's 20 to 80. I mean, that's a pretty broad range.
Oh yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's crazy. All it says is
that's really close to between 0 and 100.
I know. I shave 40% off the absolute range of percents.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't even get rid of 50%. But so just a reminder that when people have serious illnesses, infections, they can develop long-term symptoms that are slow to resolve, but mm-hmm. resolve over time often. And there are a lot of guidance documents right now for long COVID. So I encourage you to check out the Tools for Practice, because we linked to a lot of them. There's ones about following if there's chest symptoms. There's one from Quebec in English and French that gives a lot of good guidance. Basically, one of the things they consistently all say is, if there's a symptom, you can investigate it. But it doesn't, you know, the investigations don't necessarily confirm or refute the diagnosis mm-hmm. of long COVID. It's something that's a symptom-based diagnosis. It's not based on testing. The testing is to make sure, like when we found out, as I mentioned earlier, that a fair number of patients get damage to their lungs from this infection.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So I think, you know, investigating that is reasonable if it wasn't investigated before. But there's not like a shotgun type approach. Well, you've come in with this illness, so now we have to order, you know, you've got lingering fatigue, so now we have to order a full body MRI and a panel of 200 tests. It's not quite like that at all. You follow the fatigue, so you would order a TSH and a CBC and those kind of things.
Yeah. I mean, I think the bottom line. I mean, the risk of long COVID is not a small percentage. There is enough that this causes a problem. And we're talking 60 days post. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, even at 8 months or even 6 months past, when we look at the numbers, you're still, half of the people still have the symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not going away super quick. They can be reassured that in most patients, they get rid of their symptoms over time, but we don't have anything beyond 8 months now.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so it's going to take some time to know exactly what's going to happen for those patients.
Yeah. And I was going to say, you do see people who get the flu that have long-term complications, but not like this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is a different illness altogether. Yeah.
And I think it's an important thing to realize that it's, you know, when we watch the news reports, we hear, you know, we look at the numbers of people who are, you know, got hospitalized or who died, and also the number of people who got COVID. This number is not brought up all that often. It's mentioned, but this is an important endpoint because it is a really important additional risk, if you will, that we don't see, like I said, as much with the normal everyday flu and you know, it's like I said, it's more like the equivalent of tuberculosis, I guess, with so many differences, you know, but you know what I mean. This does some damage.
Yeah, like I think what you're getting at, James, is if you see in your province or state or whatever that there were 1,000 cases, even if you take the lower end of this range, that means that 200 people will have symptoms at least to 60 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it'll be irritating and frustrating for them, and maybe even limiting.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe 10-12% of them will have symptoms at 8 months.
Yeah.
So we're talking, you know, 10-12% of the original number. Yeah. So that means that 100 or so will still feel unwell to some degree at 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're seeing these numbers, realize that it's not just that acute illness. These people are going to. It appears that people are going to feel unwell or at least symptomatic in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
For a prolonged period.
No, for sure. So no, I did already said that you guys did a great job. I know this was a difficult one to do. It's you know, the evidence is murky, and but there is a lot of it.
And it's so conflicting and so different. So to kind of capture that and not be too selective, right? That's one of the keys.
Yeah.
We always have to try and be in tools for practice and any evidence things we're summarizing, not pick the studies that we like.
Yeah. No, exactly. And
cleaner answers just because cleaner.
And it's great to have lots of evidence, but for tools for practice, you know, better than I do, when you have lots of evidence and it's murky, it is difficult. It's much easier to have minimal evidence and one very good study.
Yeah, absolutely. Easier. So this is one of those ones where we actually use, not that people want it. This is like my last one in the premium podcast talking about how you do cluster design analysis. So but in this case, we actually use more of a systematic review type approach where we actually extract data and then we have dual extraction and comparison because we just, it's so complicated. It's better to be careful.
Yeah.
And.
Really good job. And I think, you know, this... at least now you have some appreciation of what long COVID is and what it means. And, you know, you're not going to necessarily get better answers a year from now. This is probably what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anything else, Mike?
Nope. That's good, James.
Okay. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.